thing. But be the spectacle what it might, I could afford neither consternation, scream, nor swoon. Besides, I was not overcome. Tempered by late incidents, my nerves disdained mystery. Warm from illuminations and music and thronging thousands, thoroughly lashed up by a new scourge, I defied spectra. In a moment, without exclamation, I had rushed on the haunted couch. Nothing leaped out or sprang or stirred. All the movement was mine. So was all the life, the reality, the substance, the force, as my instinct felt. I tore her up, the incubus. I held her on high, the goblin. I shook her loose, the mystery. And down she fell, down all round me, down in shreds and fragments, and I trod upon her. She acts, wordlessly. She tears up the false image, sends it to hell, deconstructs the fiction as it turns out, finding that the nun is a long bolster dressed in a long black stole and artfully invested with a white veil. Mystifying religion, false hallowed images, sanctified women, virginal religious women, unreal powers, creative artifice, the whole thing is sent to hell, dismissed and shredded, demystified, as Lucy, who is again coerced by circumstances, by her own terror, but this time who is all alone, facing only a disembodied woman, a specter, a creature maybe of her own mind, and maybe and also of convention, acts conclusively, decisively, and wordlessly, and on her instinct. She banishes the specter from her bed, and so she can assume that bed. The earlier actions of teaching and acting and writing had made her feel empowered, exalted, dismissive. Now she feels purged, and she can peacefully go to sleep. She's not altogether purged of doubt from this point, nor is the narrative, but she is. It's important that she's able boldly and conclusively to act on her own feelings. Something has been achieved. As we read it, we expect that Lucy's Nose will be a love story, that she will marry one or another of these men. And so our expectations, which are aroused deliberately by Charlotte Bronte, who then deliberately jeers at us for having them, are disappointed in the course of the novel. I think the important thing that happens instead of the love story's resolution, the love story's smooth continuing to a climax and then a resolution, is that we are shown the story of a woman's accession to the power of acting, to the power of translating her being, which I've called her desire, into doing. And I think that's where I want to end, except I have another sentence that maybe I should read. When she wrote Villette, Charlotte Bronte anticipated, I think, our interest in what to do as opposed to what to be, which is the focus of the traditional novel that is dominated by the heterosexual plot. Who Lucy is, finally, the answer to the question, who are you, Lucy Snow, is what she can do, what she does, what she has done. And this novel suggests that a woman can act, and that her actions, as opposed to her lineage, where she comes from, or indeed what she makes herself, is what's important. And for that reason, I think Villette, which is in the tradition, is non-traditional.
I'm going to stand up just because it makes me feel more in control. Because I don't have it yet.
You can stand
up. Yeah. I'm not going to talk about plot or structure, really. And while I'm going to be emphasizing the differences in the development of writing by women of color and white women, I could also be talking, and maybe I will in another conference, about the similarities and the development. Um, Did everyone see hear the choir this morning?
Yes.
You heard my talk. I really didn't need to say anything else, actually. Because I've studied more as a writer than a researcher or an anthropologist or a folklorist. And the reason that I've looked at any of these forms and structures and development is to enhance my own writing, fiction, poetry, and literary criticism, and to help in my teaching so that I can get an understanding, at least preliminarily, of where our writing comes from in order to see where it might be going. And I think understanding that process is crucial to placing the work of women of color in the context of world literature. And there are a couple of impressions that I've gotten which I think are elemental to understanding that place, our place in world literature. The first and really the most elemental is to accept that there is indeed a tradition of literature among women of color, and that it grows out of elements very specific to that culture, to those cultures, just as does the literature of anyone else. And I know this may seem somewhat obvious, but as a black woman who sometimes publishes in non-black publications, that's something that's frequently overlooked. When I read books by women of color, published by white-controlled presses, sometimes it is so clear to me that this book has been published because she is a woman of color. It has nothing to do with her skills as a writer. I can look at a book and see clear lack of editing. I can see the existence of haphazard analysis, incomplete research, poor bibliographies, poor grammar. And I wonder if the publishers and the editor would have treated a white writer so sloppily. And I realize that the editor is bending over so far backward because possibly they feel it is a miracle that they've got this manuscript at all from this black woman. And while that grows out of a tradition or an attempt to be liberal and act affirmatively, it can go over to the other side and be racist. There is the dancing dog theory, which Linda Powell mentions in Conditions 9 in a dialogue that we had about black feminist criticism, in which she says, a man standing on a street corner, you know, with whatever, hurly-burly grinder, whatever, and he has this dog, and he encourages everyone to come and see this dancing dog, and it's wonderful, and people go up, and there's this dog, and there's this music, and the dog is hopping around, but it is no way resembles dancing. So, but for a dog, it's good, you know? So the dancing dog approach to black women's writing puts us at a severe disadvantage when we begin to look back at the body of literature that has been published. It is not a miracle that black women are writing. It's only that it has evolved from other beginnings. Unlike classicists of old, I do not believe that creative gifts are simply blessings from God. I'm more inclined to look at them as legacies from my ancestors. I mean, that is a religious concept, but I feel like, you know, my great-grandmother and the other men and women who came together to create the progeny and to create the genealogy that produced me are my muses. And while I share a good deal of the prevailing cultural history and experience of this country, like I speak English, I've always spoken English, I grew up urban, I'm educated. A large portion of my cultural experience is totally alien to this larger society. And in fact, many of the European systems of thought and attitudes toward culture specifically might be considered antithetical to the very primal impulse in my life experience. And the blending of these, some say opposing, others would say complementary forces, the blending of these gives birth to the work that I do. You are all already familiar with European traditions, and most literary figures, including feminists, tend to use the same reference points in the development of form and content and style. But the African, like the Native American, traces a different route. Both groups' languages were traditionally spoken rather than written, and I think this is the key for me in looking at the literature of women of color in this country. For centuries, black and brown people maintained their sense of history and culture through a griot or storyteller who would recount family lines going back several generations, revealing not only names and relationships, but often colorful and specific anecdotes full of intricate motivations. Moral laws were learned through a complex system of fables, none of which were written down until very recently. When Africans were stolen and brought to this country, tribes were deliberately separated to prevent that communication and for economic reasons. They didn't want people to get together to be able to plan to escape. So because Africa is a land of many tribes, many, many languages, which don't overlap or interrelate necessarily, tribes were split up so that people would arrive in this country and never be able to speak the same language of the people with whom they lived, if that could be called living, for possibly years until they were able to communicate. Still, information about life in Africa, about the Middle Passage, and about the concept of freedom itself were all passed down orally in spite of all of these barriers that were presented. Often Africans veiled their messages in Christian songs like the ones we heard this morning, and there have been studies done going through some of these gospel songs outlining where in fact songs like Go Down Moses were often used as code words for escapes and things like this. They often use Christian songs and rituals in order to prevent slave owners from suspecting them of being able to communicate with each other. Frederick Douglass's master said that learning unfits a nigger for slavery, and of course he was right, and that's why blacks were forbidden in this country to learn to read for quite a long time, because it was clear that while the oral tradition helped Africans to survive in their captivity, ultimately, in order to continue to survive, they would have to learn and know what their captors knew, and most of that was written rather than transmitted orally. And when Gutenberg invented the printing press, he created the answer to the traditional Western European need to have all knowledge under control and to put it in some sort of box and then usually sell it. But for tribal culture, things were not set apart that way. Culture was not something that you bought the best ticket in the house for and went to. It was not something you curled up in an easy chair with in quadrifying sound. Rituals and all of the cultural manifestations were participated in as a body, as a unit, much like that choir sung and moved as one voice this morning. The rituals of religion formed the core of cultural life, encompassing all of the art forms. And the rituals of the group touched all facets of African life: hunting, farming, growing up, marriage, courtship, death. And the spiritual subtext, the life of the ancestors who continued to live around. They did not disappear into a hole in the ground. This cultural element was a unifying link between the people, not a pastime. Another aspect in the development of the literary tradition, and again, this is an elementary idea for some, is that the sound of the human voice has an important role in oral communication. While we do understand that to a certain extent, I mean, we can read self-help books and they, you know, teach you how to sound like you know what you're talking about, and how to sit so you look like you know what you're talking about. we really don't have much more than intellectual understanding of the effect of repetitive chanting, or the importance of the pitches of your voice in when you're delivering something. Understanding it intellectually is one thing, but relearning how to use that as a craft in your writing, or how to respond to it, I think is something else entirely. One of the problems with doing a presentation like this is that you really need to give examples of things, and so as I said earlier, I could be here for 2-3 days. So a couple of things I'm just going to read. This is a section from a poem, which is a poem is a series of voices. And alone on the page, this particular section may not mean very much, but it's really in the hearing, theoretically, we'll see. This is the last section in 6. Ooh, girl, I heard that brown-skinned woman cross the way over there is, you know. Ain't my business, course, but who would have think it? And she ain't no child, neither. I seen that girl she called her niece. Ain't fooled me. Of course, she don't bother nobody and quiet as can be. Wear them pants on the weekends, though. Yeah, girl, that brown-skinned woman across the way is, you know. Yes, I know. Now, when I wrote that section, I was trying to craft that and all the other sections so that when you read the poem, you get the rhythm of the voices, the feeling of communication, conversation, and somehow you would fall into the pitch. Now, other black women who have heard that woman in particular, or others like her, will pick it up like that. But I wanted to write it so that someone who hadn't heard those voices would fall into it, feel the cadences. Because those are important voices. Those are the voices of culture that I carry with me and that have taught me how to write. Black women have been cheated, or really cheated themselves sometimes, out of many opportunities to hear and have voices like that heard. From the first publications of work by black women in the 1800s, like beginning with Phyllis Wheatley, or Harriet Wilson, who had the first fiction published in this country by a black person. From that time, we have felt compelled to justify our existence rather than to explore it. The fiction and poetry almost obsessively followed European forms, linear narrative, realism, things like that, in spite of our instincts. And the subject matter was bent to the needs of politics rather than ego. Black women wrote, for the most part, about fair-skinned heroines, primarily from the middle class, who were all very well educated and suffered enormous conflicts of conscience. These people were created in order to prove to the larger world that blacks were indeed human. So that earlier periods of development in black literature hardly reflect the shape of black women's lives in this country. And I would say also as a black lesbian writing, looking back to find those voices becomes even more complex because the codes go into deeply obscure. To know, number one, who is a lesbian who is writing, and how far they have veiled what they had to write, as did many of the white women writers who are lesbians. One of the more interesting clues is looking at blues songs. There's a whole album of blues songs called AC/DC Blues, and on it people like Bessie Smith sing songs like BD Blues, sort of Bulldog Blues, and Prove It On Me Blues, which is a song about a woman who says, you know, how all the gossip talks about her sleeping with women, but you gotta catch her in the act before you can do anything to her. So there's a that tradition really of songwriting really speaks to black lesbians about them expressing, interestingly enough, in very comic and lighthearted ways, their relationships with women. For Native Americans, their language was all but dismissed, except for a few eccentric anthropologists. Initial attempts to transcribe Indian chants left a mystified group of academics feeling that the simple-mindedness of Indian thought was of little value. The repetition of sounds and ideas outside of a cultural context felt dry on the page. The poetry was lost, often because researchers simply did not believe, as they were translating, that Indians were capable of visionary images. I want to read a cantati, which was translated from an Aztec language. And there's a series of about 90 of these extant cantaris, which were used to entertain Montezuma and his guests, and written by Indian poets. Delicious is the song root, as I, the gilded corn warbler, lift it through a conch of gold, the sky song passing through my lips, like sunshot jade, I make the pure song glow, lifting fumes of flower fire, a singer making fragrance before the ever-present, the ever-near. These translations are just now coming into existence as translators and educators are beginning to re-look at Native American culture and assume that it must have had a similar value as anyone else's. We have heard the language of Native Americans parodied so often in Western movies and on television that we never really understood that the sounds were as important as the meaning, and frequently the meaning could be quite beautiful. The black urban experience, which is primarily what I talk about, and you have to keep in mind that there is a wide range of experience. I could be talking about the black rural experience, or the black suburban experience, and that's only in America. So I focus primarily on the black urban experience. And that has yielded many manifestations of the survival of the oral tradition. Every black woman in this country has a hair story. This is true of white women too. For black women, hair has become our nemesis. It has come to symbolize all that is wrong, innately, biologically, wrong with your existence. We spend hours crushed between the knees of our mothers and grandmothers and aunts while they try to control the unruly masses of nappy hair that white society had decreed shameful and heathen. Later, we spent hours in the secret comfort of torturous beauty salons trying to make our hair resemble that of the white women we saw praised everywhere. Ironically, these became places to learn women's culture. Here we heard in griot fashion stories about our great grandmother's first marriage or the moral lessons meted out for indiscretions or remedies for heartbreak. That totally female place became a place of communication, frequently in the form of gossip, which I think only male society has decided is totally destructive. And I would say that one person's gossip is another person's storytelling. Again, it was this art of conversation that was being cultivated. That poem that I read that I wrote could just have easily been transcribed from some conversation in a beauty shop. On the streets, street corner games were all developed around wordplay and rhythm. Something like the Dozens, which was a game in which you traded insults. Like, you all know what that is, right? The Dozens is several people stand around, presumably they're friends, good friends, and someone will say, God, you're so ugly, you look like you got hit in the face with a bag full of quarters. Creates this image. I don't know where, that was one when I was a kid, I don't know where that image came from, but the thought of it is pretty disgusting. Then your friend would say, oh yeah, well you're so ugly, your face could make change. And then the next person says, oh yeah, well I hope it gives me a dime so I can call the police and have you arrested. So, and these are people who like each other. So the game, that particular game, where you traded insults, and it still is a common pastime, escalated building on ideas and building on as a contest of wit. And black males have been recognized as sort of creating and developing that art form, much like they've, you know, developed the art form of rapping. But in fact, young black women were always adept at it in their own little cliques, and had others that boys never even bothered with. And usually they were rooted in, again, sharpness of wit, quickness in language, and rhythms. There's one game that was very common when I was younger, which was like a number circle game where you all stood around in a circle and each person had a number in sequence. You know, so if there are 10 people, each person was 1 through 10. And you set up a rhythm like this, you know, if you all play that, and then you go 1, 2, 2, 1, 2, 3, and you go back and forth like that. Okay, well that's a really intricate pattern of rhythms that women have used, and I know black women use it constantly, in their sense of playing back and forth in language. And it's very recognizable in black women's delivery and timing in everyday life, and it grows out of that kind of game. These forms of communication help to develop a distinctly different attitude about the transmission of ideas. While the written word was always treasured as a means of achieving freedom, both physical and economic, the written word has also been derided because of the oppressive content of much of the printed matter that we've been faced with, and that includes much of the writing of modern feminists. Still today, quote-unquote feminists publish anthologies, collections, studies, and just totally neglect the existence of black women, other women of color, with several excuses. Sometimes, well, quote-unquote, that isn't the focus of this piece, or there's still too much research to be done there. Or as I asked a white feminist writer who'd done a study of women's relationships at the turn of the century, why she hadn't really included any mention of black women in this entire study, which is quite popular and used in most feminist studies programs. And her response was there really wasn't enough material to include them. Because third world women have taken a different path in the development of our literary traditions, that does not negate its importance. Black women were not, by and large, filling voluminous journals or posting letters to their distant and idle friends. But the tradition of their lives was setting groundwork for the hard edges of June Jordan and the flights of fancy of Ntozake Shange. Time has shown that we can master traditional forms and subjects. People like Mel Larson and Harriet Wilson and Jesse Fawcett and the current, that New Yorker writer, Andrea Lee, who has his book on bestsellers now, who interestingly enough is writing about, in 1984, a light-skinned woman and her conflict, just like Nella Larson in 1850. We can all master these traditional forms and subjects, but it is the digressions from this path that yield the most about our lives. When Zora Neale Hurston in the 20s and 30s recreated the lives of poor black women using their vivid language patterns and driving rhythms, including in one of her books, Their Eyes Are Watching God's, a wonderful transcription of The Dozens, where this guy starts on this woman and she, you know, life is such a ribbon. When she did that, male writers of the Harlem Renaissance denigrated her work. People like Paul Laurence Dunbar or Langston Hughes indicated that her writing was primitive and that the characters were irrelevant in the modern world. Civil rights movement of the 60s brought some fresh air into that arena. Black women once again started to try to write from a larger experience. They did write about racism and try to express their humanity, but they also reclaimed their old tradition, casting their words from the sounds that we were all familiar with. And this was also the height of public performance of poetry, probably, in this country. Much of that work in the 60s, while utilizing a valued oral tradition, was not often very good, since it really had to bend to serve the uses of revolutionary politics. While Nikki Giovanni was able to inspire hundreds of poetry readings or demonstrations, her work outside of that specific context frequently does not stand up. It is mostly rhythm and rhetoric, and little of our literary tradition. It builds orally, but does not take that oral tradition a step further and create on the page something that has meaning 20 years later. And it's not true of all of her work, nor of all the work of women writing in that period, but the predominant bit of it, when you go back and look at it, you wonder what all the excitement is about. And have to understand it was created in a specific political context. Entezaki Shange took that need to tell stories and that bombastic style of the 60s and the biting wit that black women used and crafted for colored girls who considered suicide and the rainbow is enough. Part of the reason for that work's major success was that it was a presentational piece. That is, it was written to be heard, and it was performed before it hit Broadway in numerous bars on the West Coast and in New York, and was crafted and shaped to be heard. And most of the poems do stand on their own on the page, because Shange was able to go beyond the 60s rhetoric and move on to the craft of the words. And on the page, the oral quality, A-U-R-E-R, as opposed to oral quality, is really evident. When you read the words, you hear the words because of the way she's able to refine them and shape them. Cheryl Clarke's book of poems, narratives, poems in the tradition of black women, goes just a bit further. The poems all have a narrative framework, yet they often reach for expression in a more abstract, mystical plane. And the predominating force of mysticism, which still exists in black life today, even though it's often unconscious, lurks beneath the surface of all of her work and tends to create this quality of conspiracy among the women who read it, so that you feel that the women in the book are conspiring among themselves or gossiping among themselves, and you are drawn into that conspiracy. And that is, to be able to create that kind of bond is really a very special quality. Other writers like Toy Derricotte and fiction writers like Linda Jean Brown and Toni Morrison, I think, do that as well. Audre Lorde's book, Zami, reads at times like a traditional autobiography. She calls it biomythography. But the book is framed by a spirit of legend, and I think she deliberately uses overstatement, episodic chapters, larger-than-life characters, as if she were telling a story, not writing a story. When Alexis DeVoe wrote Don't Explain, a biography of Billie Holiday for young adults, she created an epic poem that is a narration of Lady Day's life and a dramatic script. She weaves the voices into the text seamlessly, letting them speak for themselves. The narrative voice interacts with the characters in a personal way, involving the reader once again. Joy Harjo, Native American, uses specifically Native American configurations in her poetry. It frequently takes on the repetitive cadence of chanting. The title poem of her book, She Had Some Horses, is the result of a carefully tuned sensibility. She is able to hear both in the present and in the past, so that her poems evoke the ritualistic drawing in of energy which chants represent, so that, unlike the anthropologists who read, listened to and tried to transcribe chants 50 years ago, they had no idea why these things were repeated over and over and over and over and over again. They had no concept of the principle, you can call it religious or psychic or whatever, non-European principle of drawing energy to yourself, and that was what the repetition was doing. Joy Harjo's chants reflect that drawing in of energy and using of energy for a woman's purpose. The poems, although they use that ancient base, reflect her modern experience and her survival in this country. I don't think that it's an accident that most of the writers who came to mind when I tried to gather together women who made most obvious use of oral traditions were primarily poets. But that's another way to talk. But there are prose writers whose work represent that tradition too. I think specifically of a writer named Sapphire, who returns to allegorical fables, the kind which flourish in African society. She writes satires full of gaudy peacocks and cute little pigs and lonely incantations as prefaces to suicide. Few of her pieces have been published, but she does do them at readings and stands as a modern-day griot for other black women writers. Alice Walker has talked about the voices that move through her when she writes. And this is more than an eccentric obfuscation of her methods. It is an attempt to communicate the different ways that people experience life. We are still exploring how to make those voices heard in a way that is most natural for us. Many of us have tried to devise new ways of describing what we do, such as choreo poem or biolithography. Simply to avoid being put into that unsuitable box. But the first breakthrough for us has been recognition of those voices, and we now say out loud that we do have a history of women that we acknowledge and value. And I think that the sound of those voices speaking through us from those past centuries continues to be exciting and challenging. And frequently, merely the choice of topic is a break from the tradition for black women in this country. And as we go on, I think we will see more of an expansion of our use of the language to create, once again, the ritual of sharing and communication more than a lecture. Like today, because reading is not supposed to be like watching television. Thank you.
Do you have a question for any of the audience? Do you Are you cataloging any students?
No, I'm writing.
Speaking was right. What of your personal idea?
To a certain extent. I mean, I feel like there are these voices that haven't been heard, that I live with. And while I can write a poem about, you know, my experience with the school's living, the more important voice that I listen to is one of the people that is different dialogue, and in turn inform everyone else, because I think the more modern literature is equally as cheated by not looking at the work of Black women people as kind of the whole body. Because I hear that tradition is not doing, but that is it going to stop with people? Is it going to stop with this generation if we don't speak our mind anymore?
I doubt it.
I doubt it. I mean, it's sort of why the debate is going on. I mean, kids still play the same game, share some impulses, share our impulses. And sometimes I do speak.
Yeah.
are as, you know, the format of this particular yelling here, how really unsatisfactory it is with the reading input machine, rather than the way, I mean, there was something distinctly different. It was like, number one, number two, number three, and finally, you know, here we are now, where we communicate. And then the such a step, to me, that's much more intimate, but also much more important. I mean, I've begun to listen to the tape, but it's dead in the present, that's going on. When people come, when women communicate directly. And I think there's, in academic circles, there's far too little of that. And I think it is.
I think part of the issue really comes from the early requires that it is a participatory event. I mean, just a reading is a participatory event, and I think most of the I draw energy from the people who are sitting out there looking at me and give it back this very specific way of the people who are out there. And it's very interesting, I'm from Sweden, but my cup and my culture in terms of religion is very similar to the past. And therefore, I have a very strong I'm drawn very strongly to the way blacks worship. And that kind of chanting, I am so sensitive to that when it starts, you know, I suddenly kind of vibrate. It's something that if you experience it when you're very young, it's addictive. And so therefore this kind of thing, this kind of chanting, is something though that was totally alien to my culture because I grew up in a certain kind of church. I experienced it very, very strongly. And this is it's something about oral communication and any kind of communicating that goes on directly between people that is so much more powerful than the kind of communication that we usually do in academia. That and also in terms, I was thinking about Vivette and teaching. I mean, so many, I'm a teacher also. And I'm thinking of what a powerful tool communication is, you know, and certainly our communication, children are so sensitive. And I am too, the voice. I mean, I could just embed it with Richard Burton.
Thank you.
but she refuses to perform. And she refuses to perform, but she refuses to perform in such a way that will please the drunk men.
Right.
Esther, on the other hand, who wins and becomes the second queen by a beauty contest, she does the traditional Billy Nancy Reagan bit. But she saves her people.
Right.
Somewhat. fact that the conventions in the course of the 20th century anyway have broken down somewhat into literary forms and more on their narrative, and the attitudes towards homosexuality, at least held by lesbian writers, there's more flexibility there. On the other hand, there's a certain amount of repetition of conventional plots, and also a kind of attempt to avoid it by simply creating a lesbian romance, which really doesn't avoid it, it doesn't sort of solve the problem, just for two women who meet and fall in love, and there's some kind of problem in the recovery thereafter. You freaking that out with Happy Ever After, occasionally they might perhaps. But that, what that still doesn't do
it
is that
they go to a public concert.
But it doesn't, what you don't get, what happens then is that the novel ends where the traditional heterosexual plot ends with the couple being formed. It doesn't tell you what happened afterwards. And then it still orients the women are still showing through their sexual relationship with another. It circumscribes what can be shown through its necessity of repeating the romance. But even if you're changing the genders of those people in the plot, the extent to which that's a real improvement is questionable.
Are there any books that you would think of as a departure
from that? Well, I think some of the most interesting recent stuff has been poetry and short stories. Short stories in the conditions in Keep Nine, the conditions before last, had a wonderful set of short stories by Lena Powell, and Jane Wool is an interesting example of a lesbian writer who began to write in the mid-60s, and who in the first novel attempted to manipulate the heterosexual plot, and then stopped. Worked against plot by having a whole series of narrative centers by not having a hero or heroine, but having about six different characters. And more recently, most of her lesbian stuff has been short stories. And in the short story, there's much more flexibility. You don't have to have this plot structure, so that both in poetry and in short stories, you can talk about many more things, which is where the best lesbian writing today has been in poetry and short stories. Something like Cheryl Clarke's narrative combines a story with a poem and a poem and short story and creates that narrative without having to have the plot. There's a whole tradition that critique represented extremely experimental lesbian writing, which is always more accessible. So you sacrifice the same amount of accessibility in order to be more experimental, but then you can say things that you can't say and more accessible to them.
One of the only things that you have talked about in the idea of a probably more information than you have to commit is the possibility of giving the public. How do you do that? Possibility to do more experimentation.